Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, scorching heat, relentless rain, and shrinking federal support. Catskill's farmers are feeling the pressure. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports on how climate change and budget cuts are reshaping the region's agricultural landscape. A bill to protect the rights of trans and gender nonconforming people in New York's prisons didn't move forward this legislative session, but advocates say the fight isn't over. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett speaks with the members of the Trans Prisoners' Rights Coalition about the GERDS Act and the urgent need for reform. And the Newfoundland Area Library is buzzing with activity. We talk with Library Director Christina Russo about the surprising ways the library is serving and growing with its community. Plus, culture reporter Valerie Manzi. Now the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the U.S. strike on Iranian nuclear facilities caused massive damage. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports he attacked the press for suggesting otherwise.
The Secretary of Defense repeatedly praised President Trump's leadership in deciding to attack Iran's nuclear sites last weekend. He attacked the press for reporting on leaked preliminary intelligence assessments that cast doubt on whether Iran's nuclear program has been destroyed. Hegseth cited other Trump administration sources, as well as the international community, to assert that the mission succeeded. He said he was not aware of any intelligence that Iran might have moved some of its stockpile of nuclear fuel. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, gave a lengthy presentation, including videos of the bombs, and describing the years of planning and hours of nonstop flight by U.S. servicemen and women. But he said a full assessment of the strike was still pending. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Iran's supreme leader says President Trump is exaggerating the impact of American airstrikes on his country's nuclear sites. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei noted Iran had attacked a U.S. airbase in Qatar. He said this incident can be repeated in the future. President Trump is hosting what the White House says is one big, beautiful event today. NPR's Tamara Keith reports it's designed to push Senate Republicans to pass his tax cuts and spending legislation.
President Trump has set a July 4th deadline for Congress to get the bill on his desk, working the phones to apply pressure as he flew home from Europe yesterday. And today, an event from the East Room features Americans the White House says will benefit from the bill's tax cuts and other provisions. Truck drivers, firefighters, tipped workers, and others. The White House is pushing back on the message from Democrats that the legislation would benefit the wealthy while taking away health benefits from the poor. The measure contains the bulk of the president's legislative agenda, meaning the stakes are high for both him and his party. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a somewhat sharper slowdown in the U.S. economy in the first 3 months of this year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow jumped about 200 points in early trading.
Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the U.S. economy shrank at an annual rate of 0.5% in January, February, and March. That's a slightly bigger drop in first quarter GDP than had been reported. Much of the downgrade reflects lower consumer spending. The nation's trade gap widened last month after narrowing in April when President Trump announced his worldwide tariffs. Exports and imports were both down in May, but exports dropped more. New applications for unemployment benefits dipped last week. 236,000 people applied for jobless aid. That's 10,000 fewer than the week before. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 190 points. This is NPR. A federal judge has ruled in favor of big tech company Meta. This is in a lawsuit alleging copyright infringement. A group of authors had claimed Meta's Facebook platform stole their works in order to train its artificial intelligence technology. The judge rejected the argument, but he said this decision only applies to this group of authors. He says his decision does not mean that Meta's use of copyrighted material is legal. Protests are happening in Kenya. The human rights group Amnesty International says at least 16 people have been killed, most of them by police. Kenya's Human Rights Commission says more than 400 protesters have been injured. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu has more.
Security forces shot live rounds, tear gas, and water cannons at protesters gathered in several cities across the country. the demonstrations against police brutality mark the one-year anniversary of deadly anti-government protests against higher taxes, where more than 60 protesters were killed. The killings, some which were filmed by eyewitnesses, sparked outrage in Kenya, where security forces have long been accused of extrajudicial killings and abuses. Earlier this month, three police officers were arrested for the death of a blogger who died in police detention. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
North Korea says it has finished building a huge tourist zone in the east seaside of that country. The city, Wonsan, is intended to be a vacation destination for its own citizens. North Korea is famously reclusive, allowing few foreigners to enter the country. I'm Corva Coleman. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We're getting a break from the extreme heat today, but Governor Kathy Hochul's state of emergency for 32 counties, including Orange and Ulster, following New York's first major heat wave this week, will last until July 22nd. Hochul issued the state of emergency Sunday as government officials across the state anticipated power outages and safety concerns due to excessive heat, making temperatures feel over 100 degrees or more Monday and Tuesday, and some weekend thunderstorms and winds that could affect northern regions of the state. As you know, heat index values from 95 to 107 degrees made temperatures feel hotter all across the Hudson Valley this week. The extreme heat follows weeks of heavy rainfall, conditions that are creating new challenges for farmers. They're already grappling with major federal budget cuts under the Trump administration. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with local farmers about how this season's weather is affecting their work and how climate change and shifting federal policies are reshaping agriculture in the region.
Chamomile, hibiscus, and lemongrass are just some of the herbs that Kendra Payne says people gravitate to in the summertime at her herbal shop, The Herbal Scoop, in Narrowsburg, New York.
I mean, everybody's looking for hydration. That's like the biggest thing now that we finally have some sunny weather pushing into summer flavors.
At The Herbal Scoop, Payne says she tries to offer herbal medicine in an accessible way so that people can support their wellness and drink something delicious.
When you come into the shop, you're going to see herbs, and they're in these large jars, and there's lots of them. There's probably over 90 of them, but on each individual jar are about three things that that herb can be used for, and I do that so that people can start to build curiosity and start to make decisions on what they want to use the herbs to support.
But some of those herbs, like Kendra's favorite herb, hibiscus, don't grow too well in drastic weather changes and excessive rain. And New York State has seen a lot of rain this season. Over the last two decades, the Catskills region has increasingly seen more rainfall. Annual rainfall in Sullivan County jumped more than 25 inches from 2004 to 2024. That's an increase of more than 7 yards in rainfall. Climate experts warn that the heavier rainfall is largely due to climate change. As the earth gets warmer, the air can hold more moisture, and that water is being released in more intense short rainfall across the country, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Because of the lack of sun and the, you know, constant moisture, is that I grow a lot from seed as well, and those just aren't doing as well. And even when I go to some of the medicinal nurseries that I know of in the area, they're struggling in the same way.
This year's heavy rainfall coincides with the Trump administration freezing hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. Department of Agriculture grants, contracts that were already signed and approved for distribution. Payne says she was expecting a $50,000 grant from the Natural Resources Conservation Service that was pulled back as part of Trump's broader funding cuts.
Yeah, so the rainfall has kind of hit me in a couple of different ways. This year, I was actually supposed to have an irrigation project through NRCS come and actually help with water management and getting proper irrigation in my high tunnel. But due to funding cuts, that is no longer a thing. So I've been managing water into my tunnel, and it's, I would say, about a quarter of it floods due to the rains. And, you know, it's the Catskills, so none of us rarely farm on flat land. So we're farming on a hill, and because of that hill, a lot of water is collecting into the tunnel, which has made about a quarter of it unusable for this season.
Payne says she's been trying to use grow lights to mimic what a perfect sunny day would be like, but
it's just really not been enough. So I feel like with those things, I feel behind. I'm, you know, hopeful with this sunny day that more will come so that I can feel like I can catch up and get the type of harvest that I've typically been getting over the last, you know, 5-6 years. But I'm a little nervous to see what that looks like. Am I going to lose a round of harvest because there's just not enough time? You know, the Catskills, we have a short season, even with our high tunnels kind of extending it. So typically, let's say for the Tulsi, I can probably get 3 cuts out of it in a season. I might be working with 2 cuts because of, you know, the way that things are growing and how small the plants were when they went in to begin with. So it's been difficult in a lot of ways.
Is that NRCS grant, is that still on hold?
It's canceled as far as I know, but I would say on hold. If the funding comes back, they may, you know, kind of reinvigorate all of those contracts, but I'm just one of many, so who knows how long that will take if it ever happens. I'm kind of putting it out of my mind and figuring out ways to manage water on the farm so that I'm not reliant on it right now. If it comes, it'll be a bonus. I love it. I welcome them with open arms.
Well, tell me a little bit more about how you have had to pivot, what that pivots have looked like for you.
Yeah, so I mean, with this particular thing, with the water management and not having the proper irrigation, I've actually had to pull back on the amount of herbs that I'm growing. Like I talked about earlier, I, you know, got this high tunnel so that I could really grow a lot of hibiscus. It's one of the ones that I work with a lot. It's my favorite herb. It's in a couple of my blends. And so when this funding cut happened and, you know, the rain and stuff, I just decided to pull back and kind of quote unquote do the easy herbs that I know will kind of handle different climates, different situations, don't necessarily need a very specific watering pattern, things like that. So I just basically took it down to basics.
Due to the abrupt funding cuts, Payne says she's pivoted to growing more reliable herbs she knows will grow well, like lemongrass, bee balm, and peppermint.
In past years, I'll always have like a patch, what I call my science experiment. Well, you know, plant something that I've never planted before to see what happens. This is not the year for that. I really wanted to focus on what I know will do well on the farm and like, let's just do that instead of trying to expand or experiment with something that I've never worked with before.
But Payne isn't the only resident who had to pivot their operations due to the rainfall. On a Saturday morning in June, Maria Grimaldi is hosting a free water management clinic for homeowners, farmers, and gardeners. The name of the clinic? Water, Water Everywhere.
I think we're all agreeing this is not going to go away. It's going to possibly become worse.
Around a large wooden table at the Livingston Manor Library on Main Street, Grimaldi and 7 other attendees discuss permaculture strategies to manage and harvest water in the face of climate change.
We're trying to focus on how we mitigate these effects, particularly here in this environment, which is we have a lot of water.
Excessive precipitation can lead to crop damage, soil erosion, and increased flood risk, according to the EPA. More floods could lead to more injuries, exposure to mold, and infrastructure damage. At Grimaldi's clinic, attendees share ideas for how they've navigated in the face of climate change, like planting different plants that do well in extremely wet soil.
Mm. So different plants that you could...
like wet feet.
Yes, that like wet feet. So I have some like sweet flag. I think that's... Is that the purple iris?
Hi, how are you?
Well, they like wet feet too. Mm-hmm. And there's the yellow flags,
right,
which can be invasive, but they're great to sop up if you have a real wet spot.
At the Herbal Scoop, Payne says she's focused on serving her community with her ancestral herbal knowledge.
Herbs are political, and because it's an opportunity to kind of have that body autonomy, right? And, you know, enslaved people, when they came over, they didn't have access to doctors. And, you know, that legacy kind of continued for decades. And so, you know, the seeds that we brought over, the plants that, you know, we, our ancestors worked with, were the medicine that we used to heal our communities.
While the federal government has retracted on many of its promises and funding to farmers, Payne hopes this could be an opportunity for lawmakers to step up locally.
Sullivan County is built on agriculture. We are in a very large section of this state that grows for a living. And then a lot of these crops and stuff go to other places. And so if we can't farm up here, what does that look like? You know, we're a small county, but I think we're a very important county. And so if we don't have the support coming from, you know, local, state, and federal levels to help us manage the climate change, water management, and things like that, I just fear that we're going to lose more farmers than we're going to gain.
Payne says now is the time for community leaders, farmers, and residents to come together to talk about new sustainable ways to pivot their practices when climate change is changing things faster than farmers can keep up with, says Payne.
As farmers, if we want to keep farming, if we want to really protect the land, it's non-negotiable. It's just going to be part of what we do every season.
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And a reminder to join Kimberly on Farm and Country Saturdays at 10 a.m. This week, the French Woods Performing Arts Camp in Hancock makes a major investment in an 800-plus plant perennial native meadow. Listen for that and more on Farm and Country this Saturday morning at 10. Coming up next, Zoran Mamdani's stunning upset in New York City's mayoral primary is sending shockwaves through the Democratic Party. Progressives are energized, but can this citywide surge shift the balance of power across the state? Radio Catskill's Jason Dole reports next after a quick break. This is Radio Catskill.
Recycling can feel like a lost cause, but one college student started a grassroots effort to turn beer bottles into sand for eroding beaches.
We have some music bumping and like some people are sorting. There's one person crushing and the rest of us are like hand sifting the material.
Now you can come up with creative ideas by taking a second look. Double takes. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Angela Page from Folk Plus. On the next Folk Plus, I will have as my guest Ray Mysick. He was one of the founding members of the Greenwich Village Folk Festival that has been running on and off since October of 1987. We'll share some memories, play some music, and learn about the thousands of songs that the festival presented for listeners. That's the next Folk Plus, Sunday at 2, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Zoran Mamdani's surprise win in New York City's mayoral primary has energized progressives and sparked statewide speculation about the Democratic Party's future. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with the Capitol Press Room's David Lombardo, who says that while Mamdani's populist message resonated in the city, it's unclear if that momentum will carry beyond NYC, where establishment Democrats still dominate.
You mentioned Antonio Delgado and how he might be positioning himself for a run in light of what happened in New York City and the results of this primary. Beyond Delgado, what do you think these results in New York City might mean for the rest of New York state politics?
What we've seen over the last 6 years now is that socialist candidates have had success in New York City for the most part. There is an exception in the Catskills with Shanta, an assembly member who was successful in unseating a Democratic incumbent. But again, that also speaks to someone who ran against a very unpopular incumbent. She had a very populist message. So I think my takeaway would be, if I'm trying to replicate this success as a Democrat in upstate New York, whether it's in an assembly race, a Senate race, or a large municipality, I think the message has to be, one, stay true to yourself. Zoran Mamdani is good at this stuff, and he leaned into what he was good at. If you're not good at that, don't try to do it because voters can suss out that type of insincerity, but also that populist message is something that works. It's something that crosses party lines. Assemblymember Mamdani has talked about how he appeals to the Trump AOC voter, something that seems like an oxymoron, but it is something that exists. But like in the mayoral elections that we saw this past Tuesday outside of New York City, where there were Democratic primaries, whether it's Syracuse, Buffalo, Albany, there wasn't any sort of populist uprising. We saw candidates who were backed by the Working Families Party, the liberal third party in New York, be successful. But I think for the most part, they were very establishment aligned. And I think for the most part, the establishment has the infrastructure, they have the political support to be successful in the Democratic Party moving forward still.
And you can hear Jason Dole's full conversation with David Lombardo of the Capitol Press Room at our website, wjffradio.org. A quick break for us when we come back. A proposed bill to ensure dignity and safety for trans and gender nonconforming people in New York prisons stalled this session, but supporters are keeping the pressure on. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett explores the push for prison justice and gender-affirming care next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Gender Identity Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act, better known as the GIRDS Act, is a proposed bill in the New York State Senate that would require prisons and jails to house transgender, nonconforming, non-binary, and intersex individuals in alignment with their gender identity. It also calls for access to gender-affirming medical care and personal items. Although the bill remained in committee and was not acted upon during this year's legislative session, advocates are continuing their push for its passage. The Trans Prisoners' Rights Coalition is working to raise awareness and build momentum for the next legislative cycle. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with coalition members Mick Kincaid and Grace DeTravira about how trans identity increases vulnerability within the system and how the GIRDS Act could serve as a vital step toward protecting human rights across New York State. We should note this story contains mentions of sexual assault and violence against the transgender community.
In January 2023, the Gender Identity Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act, more commonly referred to as the GIRDS Act, was first introduced in the New York State Senate. The GIRDS Act is dedicated to protecting the rights of one of the most forgotten intersectional identities, trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming folks in New York prisons and jails.
So the GIRDS Act, it stands for the Gender Identity, Respect, Dignity, and Safety Act, and really the name of it says it all. This is an act that would require all of the jails in New York counties, as well as New York City five borough jails, as well as all state prisons, to be in compliance with certain element of respect for transgender, non-binary, and intersex individuals. And primarily amongst that is the correct housing of us. However, there's also other aspects of the bill, such as removing people from long-term solitary confinement, respectful use of pronouns and names, access to medical care, and access to the programming we need for when we re-enter.
That was Mick Kincaid, a New York State attorney who has worked directly with the Rikers Island Civil Reentry Project. He is now a part of the Trans Prisoners' Rights Coalition, working to advocate and build support around the passage of the GIRDS Act. While the bill has two legislative supporters, State Senator Julia Salazar and Assemblymember Emily Gallagher, it has been sitting in committee and still has not been passed 2 years later.
it has been a struggle to even get people to read it. Now we got people to read it. We got people to bring it to the floor or gonna bring it to the floor. So the reason why it is so necessary is because it affects lives.
That was Grace Detrevara, LGBTQ plus liaison and case management assistant at the Osborne Association and a formerly incarcerated trans woman at Rikers Island. Grace dedicates her work to protecting trans folks in the carceral and criminal justice system.
This seems on surface, if you're not a person of the LGBT community, you would think that someone is asking for something special. But read the law and you will understand that this, no one's asked, they're just, we are asking for justice, respect, and most of all, safety while in custody. No one, you don't see anything around that. We're not asking to ditch safety to give up, to call me she, her, and miss. It's respect while going to get medical care. Respect while going to court or not going to court, seeing your lawyer, not seeing your lawyer. A lot of that has to do with the characters of the training of corrections, whether it's officers, whether it's civilians. They are only doing what their superiors and that corrections allows. This law will be just another additive that they will now have to give respect, not take a choice if they want to give it or not.
According to the U.S. Trans Survey, 1 in 2 Black trans folks have been incarcerated nationwide.
And that's just an astounding statistic. There is no other population in the United States where you can say 1 out of every 2 has experienced incarceration. That is mind-blowing. And that's all Black trans people. And so that includes trans men, trans women, non-binary people. So the targeting of this specific population is very clear.
Incarcerated trans folks experience 10 times increased sexual assault rates than the general prison population. In addition, the already low standard of medical care for incarcerated individuals is heightened in a system that still does not validate the existence of trans identity.
And I think for listeners who might not be aware, or, you know, for whom it sometimes seems like we've come such a far away, it was only in the 70s when we still had cross-dressing laws in New York State that where you could be incarcerated for not wearing 3 pieces of the correct items of clothing. It was only in the 70s when being, in quotes, homosexual was taken out of the DSM, the largest psychiatric sort of reference book used in the United States. So the histories of people being incarcerated for their identity and for who they love, a good number of people have these charges on their criminal rap sheets. And that makes you much more susceptible to surveillance and interference. Even once people are inside, trans folks are susceptible to longer sentences because they have increased disciplinary measures put against them. Folks don't understand their identities and therefore sentence them to longer sentences. And people, unfortunately, in general, find us to be not credible because there's this sense that you are allowed to question who a trans person is.
GERDs may not be signed into New York state law, but Mick highlights the importance of county-to-county incremental changes towards the bill's ultimate goal, statewide respect for trans folks.
You both have done, you know, particularly spoken out against the inhumane treatment at Rikers Island. So Radio Catskill, we primarily cover the Catskills, Sullivan County, the Hudson Valley. Obviously, this would be a statewide law. What if passed, you know, what would this look like in more rural areas and more and smaller prisons and jails?
There's 18 counties in New York that have already enacted something similar to GERDs.
Yeah.
And 3 of them are after litigation. So Broome, Steuben, Jefferson, those are all after litigation. And I should say after like $1,000 settlements as well. And then 15 other counties have voluntarily implemented it. However, that's not necessarily the law. It's a policy of their sheriff's association or it's a policy of the county jail. And So it could change with administrative shifts. So I would say a county like Sullivan County would look at those other counties and sort of see how they've implemented it, given that they're on a much smaller population scale.
Still, in a system where innocent black people spend an average of almost 14 years behind bars, which is 45% longer than their white counterparts, Grace and Mick recognize that GERDs cannot be fully effective until we change our view of the method and purpose of our country's carceral system.
Is there kind of a provision of the bill that would help to address those wrongful convictions, or is that more for future, in the future of organizing?
I would say that's more in the future, but what GERDs does, I think, is that while it is working with jails and prisons as they currently are, I believe it's a bill that moves us towards rethinking carcerality, because at the heart of it, as Grace has been saying, is respect and dignity. And that's not, generally speaking, at the heart of any of our carceral principles. And so by saying, hey, actually, the person who's going into custody, they may have been charged with this crime. They may or may not have done it. But they are also still a full human. They are still a parent, a child, a member of society, someone who has great ideas and thoughts to contribute. And they should be treated as such.
Whether it's part of this bill, beyond this bill, what would be your ultimate goal to see the way we change our correctional system, whether it's in New York and then nationwide?
As a formerly incarcerated person, all we want is what everyone else gets, and that's dignity, respect, and hopefully safety. Mm-hmm. This is not complicated. The language is not complicated. It is quite clear, and it connects with everything from the time you are arrested, held in custody, arraigned, sentenced, placed. GERDs is necessary from the beginning to how I just described that. There's nothing there that has not been affected where GERDs is not necessary. It is necessary.
I think something that we sort of hope GERDs builds towards is eventually a world where we have completely rethought this carceral system. There are deep ties in the United States with genocide and colonization and enslavement and mistreatment of Black individuals in particular, and the carceral system. I have done this for about 10 years, been an attorney working with people in prisons and jails in New York, and I find that most people come home really shattered. They have had access to horrible medical care. They have been mistreated every single day. They have lived in fear of being sexually assaulted, of rape, of physical assault. And the programming that's offered by organizations like Osborne, where Grace works, is absolutely vital, but the funding is being slashed with every administration. Most of our 27 state prisons don't have any programming at all. Besides what is already offered, like AA groups. And so people don't come home with a different idea of what's available and accessible to them. They come home thinking, I have seen people treated with horrible disrespect, and I have seen that the law doesn't seem to apply equally. And so something like GERDs hopefully starts to change that conversation by saying there is respect inherent in every single person who's in the carceral system.
As Pride Month comes to a close and as sweeping nationwide laws restrict access to gender-affirming healthcare, Grace and Mick are emphasizing to allies and all New Yorkers that supporting the passage of this bill should be the next step in protecting the humanity of all LGBTQIA+ individuals.
If you have to put the LGBTQ in front of respect, then we really do have a bigger conversation. But that's where we're at right now. We're talking about safety, respect, and getting what we all would hope that we all get.
And I'll just share that yesterday, Grace and I were chatting about this bill in anticipation of the interview. And Grace said something. I maybe it's because I'm a lawyer, or because I'm often getting sort of more complex questions, and I get really into the nitty gritty of like, what's a prison versus what's a jail? How exactly would this work in certain contexts? What's the current law? And I can get really bogged down into all those details. And Grace was just like, this is a human rights bill.
Period.
That's it. Period. And I think that's the thing, that we have a lot of resources on our website that answer some of the more in-depth questions. But the number one thing to start from is that this is a human rights bill, and trans people in the United States are under attack right now. And this law would really just make a cover over New York State and say, no, from cradle to grave, trans people are who they say they are, and we will respect them here, and we will treat them with dignity.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Mick Kincaid and Grace Detrevara.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you so much.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
Thanks to Genevieve for that report. Now turning to immigration, Chantal Duster of the New York Public News Network sat down with the New York Immigration Coalition president and CEO Murad Awadeh about immigration policies and priorities in New York State.
Thank you so much for joining us here today, Murad.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. President Donald Trump's administration is currently considering a travel ban on at least 36 countries from entering the United States. What is the coalition's position on this move by the president?
You know, it's incredibly unfortunate that we saw the Trump administration put together and announce the Muslim, African, and travel ban that we saw happen in his first term happen again. In total, he's targeting about 20 countries, with about 12 of them with a complete ban on entering the United States, an additional 8 that have severe restrictions to come into the United States. And what that's going to do, it's going to harm New Yorkers. It's going to harm people who want to reconnect with their families. And we know that this policy is rooted in bigotry and xenophobia, and that the Trump administration is going to continue to wage war against immigrants in this moment. And Donald Trump and his enablers are attacking the very concept of what America is itself. So this is the really harmful moment that we are witnessing, where individuals will not be able to connect with their loved ones. People will have to miss, you know, special occasions, weddings, and then individuals won't be able to come and see their dying loved ones or wish them farewell at their funerals.
And we know in recent weeks, the president has also moved to direct federal officials to prioritize deportations in New York and other Democratic states. Was this at all surprising to the coalition?
You know, what, since day one of this administration, we've seen the administration continue to attack immigrant communities across the country. Even here, immediately after inauguration, we saw them start doing raids in upstate New York, targeting dairy farms and hatcheries. So when we see this escalation of enforcement every single day here across New York City, New York State, it's not, unfortunately, it's something that we are seeing happen across this country. So it's not unique just to New York, but it is happening in more increased numbers here in the state of New York. So that's why we continue to fight back. That's why we continue to fight for access to representation, to ensure that when people are going to immigration court, that they have the right to an attorney to be presented. If they can't afford one, one would be afforded to them. They don't have that right now in immigration court. Additionally, we want our local police departments and state agencies to not collude with immigration enforcement, because we see them doing that right now, and we don't want them to, you know, sidestep their own responsibilities. It is not the responsibility of local police or state police to be doing federal immigration enforcement. That is not their job, and that's not how we should be using our state resources in this moment.
And given the potential threat of this ban and the increased force by ICE, what do you think the state's role should be in combating federal action on immigrants?
Every single level of government has a role to play in fighting back against these really horrific policies that are coming from Washington, D.C. Within the first 100 days of the Trump administration, we saw over 260 policies come out in the first 100 days. That's about 2.6 policies a day, policies, actions, orders. So we need every level of government to step up. You know, we need the state to actually also step up in this moment and stop the collusion between, you know, agencies and law enforcement and Donald Trump's family separation agenda that he's pushing right now.
And just a few days ago, we also saw New York City comptroller and mayoral candidate Brad Lander get arrested by ICE as the comptroller was actually escorting a migrant out of court. Ultimately, no charges were brought up against the comptroller. But what do you think this event says about the overall tone around ICE and immigration in New York City?
Well, you know, Brad Lander wasn't the first elected official to be arrested by ICE. We saw Mayor Ras Baraka from Newark being arrested. We saw Senator Alex Padilla being arrested. We saw ICE wage charges against Congressman MacGyver. And Brad just falls in the same category of those individuals in this moment who are U.S. citizens who were witnessing or bearing witness to what ICE is doing and were caught up in getting arrested in the moment. So I think it's incredibly dangerous that we're seeing this happen and that ICE is operating in this way. You know, U.S. citizens are not supposed to be arrested by immigration enforcement because they are U.S. citizens. But we see them have no regard with that, nor regard to the laws on the books or the rules and procedures on the books in this moment. So it's incredibly, worrisome, but it's also an incredibly dangerous time for not just immigrants, but U.S. citizens in this country.
And Governor Kathy Hochul did testify in front of the Congressional Oversight Committee about the state's immigration and sanctuary policies. What was your reaction to the testimony given by the governor just a few weeks ago?
You know, we were happy to see the governor stand up for Immigrant New York. We were happy to see her really ensure that people understood who we are as a state. Every wave of immigration that has come to this country and to this state has built our roads, our bridges, our skyscrapers, our local economies, and continue to contribute and power our economies forward. So it was really heartening to see Governor Hochul step up in Congress and really make sure that people weren't trying to, you know, get cheap shots at our state or our policies, because we know that our sanctuary policies are actually public safety policies. And they say that at the end of the day, we want everyone to feel free to call law enforcement if they feel threatened or if they're a victim of a crime or witness the crime, if they have to go to the hospital that they should, if they're sick, and that the doctor or the nurse won't turn them over to immigration enforcement. That's all sanctuary policy is. It does not mean that we circumvent federal law. It says that we are going to ensure that we protect our residents of our state. And that's what, you know, the message that she had delivered there.
And this year, we also saw increased support for the New York for All Act at the state capitol. Now, this is a bill that would aim to limit cooperation between state and local agencies and federal immigration authorities. The bill ultimately did not make it over the legislative finish line this year. But how are you hoping to ramp up support throughout the summer in preparation for the next legislative session?
Well, it was incredibly disheartening to see the bill not get a vote on the floor of the Senate or the Assembly. We know we have the support, we have the votes, we have the numbers on our side, and we have New Yorkers on our side. New Yorkers support the New York for All Act. It is not the state's business to do immigration enforcement. It is the federal government's, so we should let them do their job, but we should not be part of that. So it was really disheartening to see the Senate and the Assembly not take up the bill and bring it to the floor. We do hear that there might be a special session coming up, and we want them to take it up in the special session so we can protect as many New Yorkers as possible.
And can you speak to some of the challenges that work to hinder the bill from getting over the legislative finish line? How will those concerns around the bill be addressed? And will there be any amendments that will be made to the bill?
Well, we have amended the bill, you know, several times to strengthen the bill and to ensure that the intent of the bill is to ensure we're protecting New Yorkers. So, you know, we haven't heard of any other issues in this moment. So if people do have them, we're happy to answer any questions that they have on the bill and make sure that we get it done, hopefully this year in special session.
And is the coalition happy with the state's approach to handling immigration this past legislative session and in the final enacted state budget?
You know, we can always go further. We were proud to have fought for and continue to fight for expanding resources and services for our communities. You know, it was unfortunate that we didn't get a significant increase in immigration legal services funding. That's something we're going to continue to fight for. And really not seeing the New York for All Act get a consideration on the floor was also disheartening. So as a city, as a state, as a country, we all need to step up in this moment. It really isn't just about immigrant communities. What we're fighting for is our democracy. We're fighting for the rule of law, and that's what we want everyone to fight alongside of us for.
And lastly, are there any other initiatives that the coalition will be taking up to help immigrants in the state?
Well, we've already been doubling and tripling down on our already expanded community-focused programming, from community education to community clinics. We're going to continue doing that across the state of New York and make sure that all of our neighbors, regardless of their status, have the support that they need in this moment.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for speaking with us today, Morad.
Thank you for having me.
And we were speaking with Morad Awade, President and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition.
And thanks to Chantal Destro of the New York Public News Network for that. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll step into the space where forest meets river and sky kisses the horizon. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi profiles Suzanne Andrews's Tree Lines and Shorelines exhibit after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
On this Old House Radio Hour, learn how to baby-proof your home, whether you have newborns or toddlers.
Any baby gate that goes at the top of a stairwell must be hard-mounted into the wall or the banister.
Plus, author J. Courtney Sullivan returns to a sea-worn home where silence, memory, and a shifting tide became the bones of her debut novel. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with artist Suzanne Andrews to talk about Tree Lines and Shorelines. It's her latest exhibit on view through July 13th at Domesticity's The Cutting Garden in Youngsville. The show invites visitors to reflect on nature's boundaries where land meets water and earth meets sky through a series of evocative works that blur the line between observation and emotion.
Good morning, Suzanne, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you for having me.
You have an exhibit at Domesticity's The Cutting Garden in Youngsville that will be running through July 13th, and you have titled it Tree Lines and Shorelines. So that gives us a little indication of what we might be seeing. But I was very interested in your background in biology and how that informs your work.
Well, I've retired recently, 35 years as a biology educator. I've always been out in the woods and playing around in water and decided to become a biologist. And then from there, got my teaching degree. And then when I retired, I wanted something different to do and decided that I would take a couple of drawing lessons. And from there, I just kept playing with color and landed on watercolors and decided that nature would be my thing because I just love being in it. And if I can't be in it, I might as well try to portray what's in my head or what I've experienced.
And you do some of these while you're out hiking and kayaking. You take a photograph first?
I usually take photos because I'm not good at speed painting.
Oh, sure,
so a lot of my paintings take a while to do. So I take several photos usually of something that piques my interest, and then I bring it home to where I sit and paint and try to capture it as I saw it.
Tell us a little bit about the work we'll be seeing at Domesticity's.
So I have things that go from shorelines at the ocean to shorelines up in the Adirondacks mainly, and also things that are woodsy, like flora and fauna of the Adirondacks. Much of it you can see around here as well, so it's not going to be unfamiliar stuff for anybody that's not familiar with the Adirondacks. The landscapes are primarily Adirondack-based.
I saw a couple online, and your colors are so very beautiful and soft and inviting.
That's what I want. I want people to experience the awe that I have when I'm in nature and how it relaxes me, and I can sit for hours in the woods and just, or in my kayak and just watch, you know, and I want people to feel immersed in that experience.
Well, I'm with you on that. I was a big kayaker myself, so I understand what that feeling is like.
Yeah, the kayak is just the medium to get where you want to get.
Yeah, I noticed you have something called tangle art.
Yes, I do. Yeah, it's not going to be in this show because it doesn't quite fit, but it's an abstract representation of just repeating patterns. So it can be totally abstract, or what I've been experimenting with lately is taking, again, things from the Adirondacks and putting those abstract patterns within them. So I just recently did a loon.
That is what I saw. Yeah. And it was so interesting because a friend of mine who lives locally was at Loon Lake.
Oh, yeah.
And she's a photographer. And she took photographs of the loons. And then, lo and behold, when I was doing research on your work, I saw your loon, yeah, which I'm going to forward to her.
Oh, cool.
Because it's beautiful.
Thank you. I love – loons are my favorite birds. When I hear them call, I'm home. So it's like, you know, it's like I've captured them in the watercolors before, but I wanted to try something a little different this time. And in the fall, I'm going to be part of the art walk in Saranac Lake, and I'm going to be stationed at the Loon Conservancy Center there.
Oh, good for you. Wonderful. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
Just you got to kind of come and see it to really experience it. Oh. It's been a labor of love and something I'm totally surprised that I was ever capable of doing. This art journey has been a complete surprise to me because it's not something I ever explored prior to 5 years ago. So,
Suzanne Andrews' exhibit, Tree Lines and Shorelines, is on view at Domesticity's The Cutting Garden through July 13th. And for more information about Suzanne's work, you can go to suzanneandrewsfineart.com. Okay, well, thank you again, and have a wonderful experience with your exhibit and all the events that you have coming up with your artwork. Well,
thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Mancy for that report. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Yesterday, we spoke to the folks at the Western Sullivan Public Library. Today, we're moving across the river to the Newfoundland Area Library along a cornerstone of its community. But it's more than just a place to borrow books. Whether you're a frequent visitor or haven't stepped inside for years, you might be surprised to hear what's happening. We're going to speak to Christina Russo now, the library director, to learn more about the library and how it supports the community and what's going on over there. Christina, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. For those who haven't visited your library in a while, what do you think might surprise them about the Newfoundland Library today?
Oh, well, it gets pretty lively in there. Because I know, like, libraries kind of have that reputation of being a place where you get shushed, but we actually get pretty loud in there. We have a lot of fun. We love when people come in. Like, we spend time chatting with people, and we have activities going on. We actually just renovated our second floor. It was a storage space, and we renovated it with a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services and with help from the community, of course. So it's a community room now, which is awesome for Newfoundland, especially because there's not really, we don't have a community center or, like, especially in the wintertime, we have a beautiful park here in Newfoundland, but not really any indoor places to do things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we have, like, a virtual reality headset up there. We have games. We have, like, a meeting space and just a lot of really cool stuff. So, yeah, we have a lot of stuff that libraries didn't have 20 years ago.
Right. And you sound like you're pretty lively and fun yourself. You're supporting the community beyond books, as you've mentioned. What are some of the kinds of programs you have for different age groups, from children up through to seniors?
So I'm very happy to say we have two programs happening right now for kids. There's a baby in me that this really amazing retired teacher volunteers her time to put on for us. And it's for babies and their caregivers up to age 3, which is pretty popular. Oh, sorry, my cat's being loud. And we also have someone else who's doing this really awesome family yoga program. So caregivers and their young kids can come and do yoga. And then we also have a needlers group that meets every week, which is really cool. And the ladies sit there and knit. And again, sometimes we'll be doing library stuff up front and they're sitting in the back and we hear them cackling and they just sound like they have the best time, which is just so awesome. And of course, we got a book club, and then we have some one-shot programs coming up that I'm really excited about.
What are some of the ways that folks can start using your services, and are they available to folks outside your regular open hours?
Yes, they are. Thank you for asking that, because we will give a library card pretty much to anybody that wants one. You just have to have a form of identification. Even if you live out of state, we could still give people a temporary card. They don't have to live in Newfoundland to get a card from us, but we also share with Wayne County, Pike County, and the whole Northeast District. So we do a lot of resource sharing to, you know, save money, and, you know, we can't buy every book and resource for our little library, so it's good for us to share. So we have so much available to people who get a library card, which is totally free. And we have our Wi-Fi on 24/7. So even if somebody happens to have their power go out or something and they need Wi-Fi, they can get it from our parking lot even when we're closed, which is really awesome. And we have a lot of e-resources too, which is like we have like job skill building that you could do online. There's we have e-books, of course, and audiobooks, which are now really popular on Libby and Hoopla. And there's educational games and things for younger kids too online. And all you need is your library card number, pretty much. So we have so much on our website, waynelibraries.org. There's a bunch of e-resources on there that are free 24/7 too.
And is that the best way for folks to find about the Newfoundland Library, that website?
Yes, waynelibraries.org. And we also have a Facebook page that we update daily, and that's facebook.com/Newfoundland Library. And we also have an email list too. So if people wanted to get emails from us, they just have to contact the library, and we can also send them email blasts about things that are going on.
Before we go, what's the one thing you wish more people knew about the library?
Oh, well, there's so much, because I think libraries are so misunderstood.
Yeah.
But I do have to say, of course, we don't shush people really anymore. I think even just outside our library, we are very welcoming and friendly now. So we want you to come in, and we want you to stay all day and hang out. We want you to see what we have to offer, because there's so much that we offer that people don't know that we have. Like even just really quick, we do faxing, we do scanning, we have tech help, community rooms, programs that are free a lot of the time. So there's just, we just really encourage people to come and stop by and see what we have, because we have something for everyone.
All right. That's Christina Russo, library director at the Newfoundland Area Library. She's not a shusher, folks. You should know.
Yes.
Christina, thanks for joining us today. And it sounds like you guys are having some fun at the library. That's great.
Yes, thank you. Come join us.
Yeah, we'll come by. Thank you. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this program and all of our local programs at our website. Just go to wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on This American Life.
I'm dead serious. I spent hours compiling a list of a couple things that make us cry. So we're going to start with like sort of our first one.
We're doing this now?
Oh, yeah, we're doing this now.
Oh, wow.
Seth doesn't cry, but he wants to. So we set up a little experiment. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, the forecast much cooler, as you may have noticed. Today, a high of 70 with showers in the afternoon. Cloudy skies early, then on and off rain showers overnight, a low of 56. Tomorrow, much cooler, high of only 63. Wasn't it 90-something the other day? Showers in the morning, cloudy in the afternoon. Occasional showers late Friday for the weekend. Saturday, 77 with clouds and some morning showers and scattered thunderstorms. Sunday, partly cloudy, 79. It's 11 o'clock.